which is evaluating success and challenges of using technology in remote villages to document the Kala language of Papua New Guinea, presented by Ken Longenecker, David Lacko, John Wagner, Christine Schreier, with Ken and David presenting.
And hi, everybody. So I'm Ken, and this is David. Christine's also surprised joined us up here in the front, too, to help deal with any questions at the end. What we're going to do is tell you about an ongoing language documentation project that we have that's taking place in an area where, in an area where things that you and I would probably consider to be normal research equipment is still a novelty, and where there isn't the infrastructure to use that high-tech research equipment that we're going to talk about today. Our hope is that by sharing these experiences, it's going to help others with planning or evaluating projects that are taking place under similar conditions or similar locations. Now, David and I are going to have some contrasting roles in this presentation. He's going to be the young, bright-eyed, tech-savvy millennial who just recently went to PNG for his first time. My role is going to be the old grizzled curmudgeon who's been working down there for about a decade, thinks he's got it dialed in and knows how to handle all the problems down there. By the end of the talk, you're going to learn that no, I haven't got it dialed in yet, because I'm going to be the one talking about our technological challenges. Before I turn it over to David, what I'd like you to do is to introduce you to our project, give you some of the rationale, and help you understand what life is like in these villages where we're working. So we're going to take you down to Papua New Guinea. This is located on the large island of New Guinea, just north of Australia, right here. And the country of Papua New Guinea occupies the eastern half of that island. Now, this country has the land area equivalent to about the state of California, yet there are more than 800 distinct vernacular languages spoken there. So incredible linguistic diversity. English is the official language of education and commerce. However, most people there are more comfortable speaking the vehicular language of Tok Pidgin. We are concentrating on a language called Kala. Our study area is right along here. This is a coastal communities along Morobe province. Okay. Our language is Kala. Kala is spoken by about 3,000 people that live in six villages that are too small to appear on this map, basically. So, and we're going to show you what the village life is like in just a little while. An interesting thing to me is that there was no orthography for the language until 2010, and that happened when our co-authors Christine and John Wagner went down, began documenting the Kala language in all six of the villages. And during that time, Christine worked with the communities, presented some ideas about how the communities could represent Kala sounds with letters or with symbols, and the community chose what their alphabet was going to be, and it's been in use ever since then. So what I'd like to do now is take you to the villages. I'm going to use a village, centrally located village called Kamiali, as representative of all these villages. My point in showing you this is to let you know exactly what conditions we're working under, and also to hopefully describe what the rationale behind our study was. So this is Main Street in Kamiali. These are some typical houses in Kamiali. What I'd like you to see here is that almost every man-made structure you can look at is produced from material sourced from the surrounding environment. It's pretty much a subsistence lifestyle down there. Another thing that I would like you to recognize is what you don't see. Okay? There's no wires in any of these pictures. Okay? There's no electrical service. There's no telephone service. There's no internet. These villages are remote enough that most of them don't even have mobile phone coverage. And the places where they do have it, it's pretty scanty at best, I think. This is a satellite image of the village of Kamiali, and that place that I just showed you, Main Street, and those houses would all be located along this beach right here. The reason I'm showing you this is to highlight the importance of the aquatic environment to the people that live there. So there's several rivers in Kamiali's territory. And of course, they've got a massive ocean, and they control all those natural resources. The rivers are important because basically it is a subsistence lifestyle. People are gathering or growing their own food. So along this northern river right here, you can see that change in coloration. That's where most of the village gardens are located, right along the river. There's the river that goes behind the village itself right here. That's the location of a swampy area. These swampy areas are prime habitat for sago palm, which provides one of the bulk starches in the diets of the people in this area. And then people spend a lot of time on the ocean. The primary source of dietary protein there, overwhelming source of dietary protein, are fish that people are catching from their surrounding environment. So the point I'm trying to make here is that this aquatic habitat is incredibly important to the survival of the Kala-speaking people. And because of that, we thought that when we go to document the language, that a majority of the diversity in their language might be related to these habitats, just based on their importance. So before I turn it over to David then, methodological stuff. Our objectives were three major ones. We wanted to create a trilingual dictionary with at least 1,500 entries. We're making an environmental encyclopedia with at least 500 entries. And we're developing a sketch grammar. Now, these top two are the tech-heavy ones. So I'm going to talk mostly about those for the duration of the presentation here. These had different techniques that we used. The dictionary is being developed through rapid word collection workshops. The environmental encyclopedia is being developed through semi-structured interviews, and I'll give you a little bit more about those now. So I'm focusing on the rapid word collection workshops now. We'd gather the village together, some representatives, present a semantic domain. We would break up into three equally sized groups and just come up with as many words as we could think of related to the semantic domain. Then everybody would reconvene and we'd make a master list. And thus we recorded the master list creation on audio and video, synced those, imported them into a LAN, and now they're annotated in Kala, International Phonetic Alphabet, Talk Pigeon, and English. And what I would like to do now is just show you a clip of what those LAN files look like so you can see what we're generating, this, the sorts of interactions we're having. So this is the master. So here are the Kala words being listed, and we're getting our definitions in Talk Pigeon. So a lot of those sorts of things are producing the dictionary. When it switched over to the semi-structured interviews, our approach depended on whether we were going into the rivers or whether we were going into the ocean. For the rivers, we'd gather a small group together. We would have our community researchers. There were at least two of those in each village. And we would have four knowledge experts, two of whom were men and two of whom were women. And in Talk Pigeon, the name for those people would be Save Men and Save Mary, respectively. Okay, so hear me use those words sometimes. But we just take a walk up the river and invite people to stop and talk about whatever it is that they would like to explain to us, things of importance in their lives. And I'm going to show you a short clip of what that looked like next. In the marine environment, we couldn't have those kinds of conversations because what we were interested in was under the water. You can't stick your head down there and look at something to talk at the same time. So what we did was a little bit of scuba diving. We swam around and took underwater video of the habitat in each of the villages. So it was village-specific video that we were coming back with. And then we'd sit down with our team, Tu Save Men, Tu Save Mary, the community researchers, and review that video. And just whenever they saw something they wanted to talk about, we'd stop the video and they would give us their explanation. We'd be recording the talking separately on audio and a different video recording then. And we left those audio recordings with our community researchers down in the villages, and they produced for us some handwritten translations of the language and handwritten transcriptions of the language and also handwritten translations. That's short methodological stuff. I'm going to turn it over to David now, who's going to tell you about some of our technological successes.
All right, so in each of the villages that we went to in Papua New Guinea, we went and we did actual computer training with the community researchers. So like we said, we had community researchers in every village that we worked in. So as the young, bright-eyed, tech-savvy millennial that I was, I brought with me a background in developing, like working with computers, developing, etc. And so what we did was we essentially came up, the research team, we came up with a script of what we were going to actually do for our computer training, and we talk about all the points. So we would split up everyone that had computer training before. We'd split up with kind of like the script of how we were actually going to train to access the audio files and that we needed to do the transcriptions. So everything from booting up the computer, and what we did is we would actually kind of build and iterate on that every single time. So if there were issues that came up, we would discuss it as a group and make sure that we would talk about those points in the next computer training that we did in the subsequent village. So we really, something that I noticed is that we really take our technology for granted. And this includes the user experience of not only the software that we use, but also just the physical hardware that we use. Something like a trackpad, where you actually have to move the mouse cursor over to an icon, can be very challenging if you've never used a computer before. And for most of the villages that we went to, the majority of the people that we were working with, some had actual computer training through programs such as SIL in the main village of, main city center of Leh. But the majority of people had little to no experience working with computers. Even headphones, the idea of putting headphones into your ears to listen to an audio file, these are things that are challenging that we take for granted every day. Just see if I missed anything. So yeah, just like, again, we went through that. And every time that we were doing our computer trainings, we noticed these things and we took note of it and we made sure that to bring this up in subsequent computer training as well. That pretty much sums that up. So training also demonstrated how to actually produce these electronic copies of handwritten handwritten transcriptions and translations. So when community researchers were finished with the translations, one of our community research partners, Gabu, went to every Kala-speaking village and picked up these translations and transcriptions and translations from the villages. And while we were in Papua New Guinea, one of our someone on our research team, John Wagner, he went with Gabu to the main city of Leh to actually go through the process of scanning the documents, putting them onto a USB stick, and also emailing them to us so that we actually receive the copies in Canada, where we could then digitize the copies in PDFs and then work from there. So one of our successes that we actually created we used essentially a wiki to kind of compile all of this information into an online environmental encyclopedia, which acts as a living document, which then will be available also in print in the Kala villages. So in terms of a CMS or content management system, we really went with doing a media wiki or a wiki type encyclopedia. Because of time and resources, it was cheap, and it was fast to do this, and it was essentially what we needed to do and handle this type of information. And we chose not to actually build a web app from the ground up because that would be very expensive. In terms of just time and resources. The design that we chose for our media wiki really draws on inspiration from the villages, the Kala-speaking villages, including at the top left, there's the logo for the larger project, Kalawala Nua, as well as just the general aesthetic of the colors and the pictures on the website. Draw an inspiration from the villages. The online environmental encyclopedia also includes audio clips, so different kind of mixed media, photographs, maps, discussion pages that allow individual users to volunteer additional information. For example, in this audio clip, you can hear a community member, Yasulin Katu, sing a song about cutting sago.
And
So later today, Christine and Margaret are actually presenting on a little bit more about songs and also children's songs in the villages. So be sure to check that out in the program. So a challenge for this large scale editing by native Kala speakers is actually going to be delayed because of this internet access challenge. So because internet access is very limited or like non-existent in many of the villages, it'll be difficult to actually work on this specific aspect of the media wiki for now. Also, many of the articles that we have actually require additional editing, just because we don't have full clarification of what the translations were. Some of the translations were actually just summaries of large swaths of Kala text and with one or two sentences in Tokpisin. So we have to go back and actually check over our translations and everything. And here's an example of one of the of where clarification is needed. You can see all these little annotations that say clarification is needed, because we just don't have enough information from the text to really have to know that, but we still consider it important vital information to include in the encyclopedia. So I'm actually gonna hand it over back to Ken to talk about some of the more challenging things as well.
And one of the first challenges that I wanna talk about is something that you and I probably do almost every single day of our lives and don't think about: logging into the computer. One of the villages we were working in, we had a community partner that was extremely concerned about the security of our equipment that we were leaving down there. He said, "Ken, I really wanna make a password. You need the password to get onto these computer screens." So we let our community drive the process and drive the project as much as possible. You know, what password do you suggest then? He goes, "Well, I think the funder of this project would be an appropriate password." So we set up National Science Foundation as the password. Well, the folks here, most of them have never used the QWERTY keyboard like you and I do, and we couldn't reliably get past the point of capitalizing the N and the S and the F in National Science Foundation. So basically, we had to shorten the password and eliminate all capital letters so that we could even get into the computer in the first place. Another problem with computer use is that adults tend to have poor eyesight. Either people are farsighted at what I think is a pretty young age, or because they're living an outdoor lifestyle very close to the equator, there's a high rate of cataracts. And remember, I'm talking about a subsistence village then. There's really no money to correct these problems. So you see some folks here wearing glasses. Those are from a donation that I organized several years ago. There's no eye doctors down there. Basically, they tried on glasses until something worked better than what the previous condition was without glasses. And here you can see Gabu, who was mentioned earlier, is wearing his glasses askew, and that's on purpose. Apparently, the left lens worked for him, but the right one did not. So he was always wearing his glasses like that. And I was the one trying to help with the computer training, and it really was heartbreaking to see how much he was struggling to see that screen. The vision problems became even more acute a little bit later on when we were dealing with some of our Save Men and Save Mary. This is not a large, in fact, it's this same computer here, what we were looking at when we were looking at that underwater video. And gathering people around, you know, they were fine with the closeness. These were a younger group of Save Men and Save Mary, but in one village we went to, the Save Men and Save Mary that were chosen for us had a difficult time seeing. And again, those were chosen by our community researchers because we would like them to drive the project as much as possible. They were picking people that they thought had great knowledge. They'd seen the video because every time we come out of the water, the village would gather around saying, "Can you show us that?" So there was a nightly screening every time we came out of the water. The community researchers knew exactly what we were going to look at, but hadn't thought that, hey, the Save Men and Save Mary are gonna need to be able to see this. And the fact was that pretty much they couldn't. I'm going to show you a clip of that next. And these are the four Save Men and Save Mary in the front, and you can see the disengagement there. They had stopped looking. The folks in the back are community researchers. They could see quite well. What they would do when they saw something, they'd whisper it in the ear of the Save Men and Save Mary, and then we would get a narrative about what that thing was. But it was a lot less productive process than when we had the Save Men, Save Mary that could actually see stuff. We got a lot less information simply because the community researchers were younger and didn't know the language as well. Other problems we had, so those were health-related issues. Other problems we had with using technology is, or climate-related. It rains a lot in this part of New Guinea. They get nearly 15 feet per year. Okay. And here you can see just one of the rainy days. That creates a couple of problems for us. The first one I want to talk about is humidity. And this is relative humidity right up there. And to put that in a human context, if you go to a website and look up, you know, what's the weather like in New Guinea, it's described as either oppressive, or one site I saw just called it downright miserable. Okay, you can't get away from it. And another point here is, again, look at the buildings. There's open windows. Walls are made of loosely fitted slats or loosely woven plant material. So you can get out of the rain, but there's no climate control. You can't get out of the humidity. And that caused problems with some of our technological gear. We were aware of this. I've taken the somewhat odd approach of showing you our data management plan. But we started that data management plan with, hey, the weather's going to be a challenge for us. We're going to do whatever we can to try to overcome these challenges. And when I talk about challenges to tech, that includes low tech as well. We had to have a special protocol for paper. The last presentation talked about paper disintegrating in some of these tropical climates, and certainly it happens there. So we have waterproof paper that was always kept in plastic bags with desiccant packs. Our high tech had to take similar approach. We thought fewer moving parts, the better. So everything was recorded onto solid state media. All of our computers had solid state drives. In fact, when I went to my institutional tech guy, I said, hey, this is the situation we're going into. This is the sort of thing we need. He came back right away with me and, look, rugged appears twice in this very short recommendation for a type of computer. Saw waterproof keyboards and military grade, and I was sold, right? This is going to be awesome. Well, we get down there, and by the end of the first trip, one of the three computers that we'd taken down was failing. It wouldn't work anymore. I brought it back to Honolulu to have it fixed, and as soon as I get in an air-conditioned environment, the problem resolves itself. There's nothing that I can show anyone that's wrong with the computer at this point in time, okay? So the humidity is a problem, and some of the tech didn't work. And David did solve a lot of the tech problems down there in the field, by the way. Another problem for us is with this rain is the cloud cover. What this graph is trying to show you is that we have mostly clear to partly cloudy skies. You can only expect that up to 25% of the time during 1 month. The fact is that skies are overcast here. Skies are overcast 50% of the time to 80% of the time. Okay. Remember that we didn't have any electrical lines down there. So we had to find a way to generate power. We thought the solution was going to be portable solar panels and integrated batteries. I'd used them in the past successfully with very strict power management protocols. John Wagner was left down there with the same gear and kept his computer running. Again, we were aware that it was going to be a problem. We warned the funders in the data management plan that, you know, this might be an issue, and we're going to do what we can to try to get enough power to do the work. We left the solar panels and the batteries with the villages, gave them training on how to use things, and with the first round of documents that came back to us, there was, the computer doesn't work. We can't do any more work. And because communication is difficult, and because there's not much technological knowledge down there, we don't know what the actual problem is, but I suspect the batteries on the computer were discharged, and there hasn't been enough sunshine when the rainy season really kicks in to recharge them. So it might just be a matter of power. So I want to close up now by saying that none of the problems that we've encountered are insurmountable. Okay, our paper management plan seems to be working. Instead of the green initiative that we've taken down there with the solar panels, next year we're going down in May and we're giving everybody a gas-powered generator and enough fuel to keep the project going for the time that they need it. Our computer that failed, fortunately we had a lot of Zoom recorders. We've downloaded or upload, what do you do? Download or upload to the Zooms? We put the audio files in the Zoom recorder. We put the audio files in the Zoom recorder, and then the community researchers could hear the audio that way. So we got the transcriptions done despite the computer failure. And when we go back this time, I'm trying to make it a little bit more comfortable for the people viewing the marine video. I have now a portable battery-powered projector and a collapsible screen. So we'll try to show it on the big screen. And with this is I want to close by saying that I sat back and reflected on what our problems were, and at this point in time I really think in retrospect The problem was a lack of my imagination. I was the one primarily responsible for organizing a lot of the field logistics. And it never dawned on me, for instance, that when we go in and we're setting up community researchers, asking them to find our Save Men and Save Mary, that we need to actually specify that the folks need to be able to see the screen. Okay. So my point is that you're probably, if you have a similar project, you're probably going to encounter hurdles, but with some adequate forethought, really considering the social and the environmental challenges that you're likely to encounter down there, you would be able to lower those hurdles and have a lot fewer of them, I think. So we'll close with thanks to our funders, thanks to some people here from UH who are also on the project, and I really want to close with a big acknowledgement to our Kalispeakan communities. They really did help to improve the project. They're helping to drive it. They're helping to organize it. They're helping to manage it. And they realized quite early that we have different views coming into their community, and they've really done a spectacular job of trying to help us understand their environment from their point of view. And it's given us, I think it's vastly improved the project, and we've taken in some places that we didn't originally envision when we first started things, just based on the feedback they've given us. So thanks very much, and we can take any questions
now.
We have time for some questions.
Yeah, so I'm curious about the media wiki that you said again. So, especially surrounding the culture of it. So, Wikipedia has a strong culture run by its editors who volunteer to maintain certain standards of quality that they've decided they want to pursue. So, you mentioned some of the concerns you had for your media wiki setup surrounding like whether or not the translations should have exactly the same material, for example. So I was wondering about the extent to which you want to try to establish a culture and or maybe you just want to sit back and let the community decide what to do with it, right? And then how you're going to try to have that culture be established and be sustainable.
Yeah, I think the idea behind it using a media wiki was also was the idea of contribution from community, with the high hopes that this will be able to be accessed as soon as internet becomes available. What we're seeing across Papua New Guinea is actually mobile phone usage is increasing exponentially, and mobile coverage is actually increasing as well. So for all we know, we could go down next time in Papua New Guinea and there could be a cell phone tower there. The idea is to get ahead of the game too and get this content on the online, create these domains of use in Kala before it becomes accessible as well. And hopefully that this becomes a resource for the community that they can draw on for either inside in their school system, hopefully, or just community members that are actually interested in the encyclopedia. Yeah, so getting kind of ahead of the game in a lot of ways.
Thank you for all this good practical stuff. I also done some training in Papua New Guinea, but in the highlands, and I'm curious about something. A friend of mine there said to me, the problem is that when I hold an axe, all my fingers do the same thing at the same time. And now you want them all to do different things, right? And we found that there, people didn't have fine motor skills, right? So like using a mouse or a trackpad, it just, nothing in their normal life required these small movements. And I'm curious, on the coast, are people working with fishing line and so forth, and maybe, and so they do have fine motor skills?
Fine motor skills, so yeah, making fishing line, some of that technology has been lost, the old technology, so now people can purchase their fishing line, but certainly one of the most fascinating things for me was we went out and somebody made fiber out of pandanus root. And it was a spectacular experience. Like, I didn't know what they were doing because I'm not a linguist, by the way. I'm a marine biologist. So this was all totally fascinating to me, what I was experiencing. So this guy starts pulling on the pandanus root, and all of a sudden it turns into this fiber, and he starts twisting it into a string. So the old folks still have that knowledge. So I think there is a lot of manual dexterity, and I would say the women too. You know, a lot of the activities are bilum making, and I don't know the bilum style up in the highlands, but down in the coastal area they tend to be string bags. So there's this constant manipulation with the fingers, and
I never tested like men versus women. That's an interesting.
So here's and this is not a linguistic thing, but because I'm a marine biologist, I do other sorts of projects, and we do fish reproductive analysis, and there's this job where you make slides, and the women hands down, are always better at it than the men. So again, there's that, the fine motor skill and the fine work is taking place, and this making slides is a fine microscopic process, and their hands are doing the right things. They have a much, much easier time, and I can generally tell whether it's a man or a woman that made a slide without ever having seen them make the slide. There was a question back there.
Time for just one quick one.
Just a quick question. As far as using mobile phones for accessibility, I'm wondering how you plan to deal with the new registration of SIM card requirement in PNG. At least where I work, it's basically meant that nobody can use a cell phone because if you don't have a national ID, you can't get a SIM card anymore.
Really? Because my SIM card expired. Can I not get a SIM card?
You can. Oh. As long as you have an ID, I mean, you
okay.
can land in Norsky and get a new SIM card. Mm-hmm. But anybody in the village, unless they have somebody there who has a national ID, you can't get a SIM card anymore. And if
wow.
you have an ID, you can register only up to 6. So, like, you with your ID could help 5 other people get a SIM card, but that's it.
So there's going to be a big black market for SIM cards.
This is the same problem with mailboxes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that.
I hadn't heard it either. So.
Yeah, we also have a problem maintaining mailboxes because
yeah.
people also need national ID to get a mailbox a lot of the time, and so and you have to renew them every year with funds, and then people don't take the funds there by the time. So communication continues to be an issue where we are. For many of these reasons. So, yeah, we hadn't thought of that.
Okay, we need to wrap up. Let's thank our presenters.
Thank you.